So I grew up right next to the Rocky Mountains, and it was a short driving distance to mountain ranges and beautiful ski resorts. And one of the things that I love to do more than anything on earth is go snowboarding. If I'm in the mountains and I'm riding down a hill on my snowboard, I'm a happy man. That's my happy place. So I know what some of you are thinking. A while back, Ryan preached a sermon and he talked about surfing. Now he's going on about snowboarding. Someone needs to explain to this guy that we live in Houston. We are in Houston, Texas, after all. It's going to be like almost 100 degrees today. So I get it. I need to find some new hobbies. But listen, I don't have any skeet shooting stories for you or any duck hunting stories. So we're just going to have to roll with snowboarding today. Is that all right? All right, good. Here we go. So after college, I had a job in the purchasing department of a nationwide sporting goods retailer, and my boss was the head buyer for all the ski inventory for hundreds of stores, and he was a good guy to know. He was responsible for buying millions of dollars of ski equipment, and what that meant is that he was regularly schmoozed by sales reps. They really wanted him to be their friend. So I talked to my boss, I asked him, can you hook me up with the snowboard of my dreams? And he made one phone call to a vice president at a big manufacturer, and that was all it took. He ordered me a top-of-the-line snowboard package. It was beautiful, and I was obsessed with that snowboard. Well, one year for Christmas, Katie and I traveled to see my family, and we're there for the holidays, and we planned a ski day at one of my favorite spots. And it turned out that it was a horrible day to be at a ski resort because it was like around December 27th. And if you've ever been at a ski hill close to Christmas time, you know it was way too crowded. There was people everywhere. There were long lines. And so as a group, we decided, hey, let's go to lunch early and we'll beat the lunchtime crowd. So we went inside the lodge. I enjoyed a nice lunch. Then I came back outside to the spot where I had left my amazing snowboard, and as I looked around, my heart sank, and my gut started to turn with anxiety, and I started to panic because my snowboard was gone, and someone had taken it. I was freaking out. By the way, if you get emotional at this part of the story, it's okay. There's tissues in the pews if you need one. I get emotional too. It's understandable. So in a twisted effort to mock me, the ski resorts have all these signs posted that says, lock it or lose it. And I thought, they're so smug, lock it or lose it. Well, guess what? I didn't lock it and I lost it. So to make it worse, I actually own a lock and I normally use it. I had left it in the car for some reason. And I remember when I set my board down thinking like, just this one time, it's gonna be okay. No big deal. Well, it wasn't okay, because my board was gone. But I maintained hope, and with my chin up, I spent the rest of the afternoon doing everything that I could do to get my snowboard back. So the first thing I did is I combed through racks and racks of skis and snowboards. I thought, maybe, just maybe, somebody picked mine up because it looked like theirs, and then they accidentally set it back down in the wrong place. And so I looked at every pair of skis and every snowboard all around the lodge. And then I went to the ski patrol office. I told them my awful story and how horrible it was, and they were nice enough to listen, and they said, fill out an official report. And so I did that. And then finally, in desperation, I went and I stood at the base of the hill where hundreds of people are finishing their runs, and I looked at every single snowboarder that was at the bottom of the hill, thinking someone's ruthlessly joyriding my snowboard. And in hindsight, I was wondering, like, what would I actually have done if I had found the person? Like, would I have walked up kind of awkwardly and said, like, excuse me, I think that's my snowboard. Could I please have it back? I like to think that I would have just charged at them full speed and taken them down J.J. Watt style. I didn't play football growing up, but I played hockey, so it could happen. Clearly, I was not of sound mind, so this was not my best moment. Eventually, things began to sink in, and I started to accept what the ski patrol officer told me. He said, you know, there's a reason we have all those signs up. Stuff gets stolen all the time. Most likely the person that took your snowboard is not even on the resort anymore. They've left and they're going to sell it on eBay. Maybe they're riding it, and at the end of the day, when they're driving down the highway, they'll like chuck it in a ditch so they don't get caught with it. So things were not looking good for getting my snowboard. I was heartbroken. I went back to the place where I had left my snowboard, and there was this kind of wooden railing, and so I just like slumped down onto that, and I stood there for a long time, and I was depressed and sad. I was pathetic, okay? A pathetic sight. But I know you've had this same feeling before. Probably not from a missing snowboard, but you have lost something valuable. Maybe it was a special photo album, or your grandma passed down her diamond ring to you. Maybe you have a collection of Lord of the Rings figurines. I don't know. No judgment from me. But when your treasure went missing, you were filled with strong desire, and you took desperate measures to hopefully get it back. Well, sometimes the Holy Spirit's just really tangible. Like, you can feel the Spirit in your bones, and the Spirit convicts you with truth, like right in the moment, right in your circumstances, like smack. God's just trying to tell you something. In that moment of longing, as I was sulking on that railing, I had this overwhelming thought come to me. I'm standing there, and I realize, you know, this situation, this is the exact idea that Jesus was trying to communicate when he talked about a shepherd that left his flock of 99 sheep because one of those sheep had gone missing. And then he tells about the woman who, she puts the lights on, she gets her broom, she looks all over her house until she finds her lost coin. And then there's a loving father that he looks off in the distance day after day, and he's hoping and longing that the son that he loves will finally return back home. So honestly, for me, in that spiritual moment, I kind of had this mixture of emotions. I suddenly felt peace and comfort just by seeing God's truth clearly. I felt like he was comforting me. But at the same time, I'm like, wow, like God's using this as a teachable moment right now. Like, I really wish I didn't have to have my snowboard stolen for me to learn this lesson. But the Lord works in mysterious ways. So the picture that Jesus creates is a loyal God that longs for missing treasures, a God that eagerly searches for what is lost, and he celebrates with anyone and everyone when his treasure is found. So let's look at Jesus' parable of the lost coin today. It's a short story. It's in the middle of the parable of the lost sheep and the famous prodigal son story. And it's about a woman that loses a valuable silver coin. So this is Luke 15, verses 8 to 10. Jesus says, "Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I've found my lost coin.' In the same way, I tell you, there's rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." So here's some background on these coins. The lost coin in this parable is not like the coins that we have today. It's not a penny that you see on the street and you just don't even bother to pick it up because it doesn't seem worth it. It's not like the loose change that you have in a dish on your desk that you've totally forgotten about. The coin in this parable has more value than pocket change. It's a silver coin that was Greek currency called a drachma, and it's worth about a day's wages for a common worker. So we get the impression this woman is not wealthy, and these 10 silver coins are all of her savings, which means this one silver coin that she's lost is like 10% of all the money that she has. And that's something that you search carefully for. Like, most of us would be upset if you lost a full day of income, if you lost 10% of all the money you have, that would be upsetting. I mean, I get annoyed when my kids lose meaningless things, like forget valuable stuff, but they just lose meaningless things, and it happens like when they're brand new, and that drives me crazy. So their latest thing is they either lose or break that little silver Apple TV remote. Have you seen this thing? It's like it's really tiny and sleek, and it's not very durable. And we're on number three. We just go through these things fast. And I think it's one of Apple's evil plans that they got together as a way to make money. They're like, let's make a remote that either gets lost or broken the second you take it out of the box. And it's not going to be a big deal as long as you never want to watch TV with it without having it. Like, you can't watch Apple TV without it. So that's what's going on in the Bean household. They just lose stuff. So some biblical scholars, they see another way to view these coins. During Jesus' time, people hearing this parable, they might have understood the 10 silver coins to be a dowry that was given to the woman as a wedding gift. And some women wore coins from a dowry, actually as like an ornamental headdress. And each one of the 10 silver coins in the headdress kind of had like its own significance and special meaning. Historians also say that women in villages wore coins as a necklace. So if you lose one of those coins, that it just ruins the value and the beauty of the jewelry. It would be like for us, if you lost a pearl off of a beautiful pearl necklace, or if a diamond went missing off of a wedding band, the wedding ring itself is worth a lot of money, but the sentimental value that's attached to it makes it worth even more value. So the woman in Jesus' parable, she searches carefully until she finds this valuable silver coin because it's special to her. It has meaning and it's valuable. And when she finds that silver coin, she's so happy. She gets all her friends, she gets all her neighbors together, and they celebrate that she's found it. So, you know, you only throw like the craziest party ever if you've got something that's really special. Well, I'm sad to say that my story doesn't line up with this parable perfectly. I never found my snowboard. It's gone forever. We all have burdens to bear. This is one of mine. Again, there are tissues in the pews if you need one. The ushers are standing by, ready to bring you a box. I know this is emotional. But God used this experience to really teach me something about his heart for you. So I've got three questions for you to think about today. Here's the first question. Do you believe that you are God's treasure? Do you believe that you're God's treasure? God's message for you in Scripture is that he cherishes you. He will never, ever give up on you, and he will passionately go after you. But the truth is, some of you, you don't feel like a treasure. You have hurts, you've got wounds, there's mistakes that you've made and hang-ups and regrets and all of those things. That makes you feel like trash, not like a treasure. You think because you messed up, God's distant. Maybe it's that something or someone has hurt or damaged you to a point where you wonder if God even cares. I want you to listen to me. You are not damaged goods. God does not see you that way. In God's story, you are at the center of the most dramatic rescue of all time. You've heard the classic story about Helen. So in Greek mythology, Helen was the most beautiful woman in the world. Men, they traveled from all over, long distances, hoping to meet her and hoping to win her affection. And it was Menelaus of Sparta that married Helen. And there's different versions of this legend. It's Greek mythology, so the details can vary. But basically, in one version, Prince Paris came from Troy to visit Menelaus. And while he was there in Sparta, Paris fell madly in love with Helen. In fact, Paris was so infatuated with Helen that he kidnapped her and he took her back to Troy. So understandably, when Menelaus finds out that his lovely wife has been abducted, he's not happy. So he assembled the largest army the world had ever seen, and he launched 1,000 ships into the sea in order to find Helen and bring her home. And the face that launched 1,000 ships, that's the beginning of the Trojan War. That's a grand story for all ages, and Hollywood even made a movie about it, but it is nothing compared to how much God desires to be with you. You are his Helen. That is the heart that God has for you. Our God, the creator of the universe, King of kings, Lord of lords, wants to be with you so much that if anything separates you from him, he launches 1,000 ships into the sea to bring you back. God has a heart for you. He's on a search and rescue because he treasures you. And what's radical is he will go after you again and again and again. When you are down and out, when you've messed up, when you feel lost and distant, God is always with you. God pursues you. He's close to you. He never leaves you behind. And you don't have to prove yourself worthy. You don't have to perform your way out of it to earn his affection. You are always his treasure, and being with you makes him want to celebrate. It is life-changing when you learn to accept that no matter what you've done or what's going on in your circumstances, God is with you, and he sees you as a treasure that he adores. Do you believe that you are God's treasure? The second question is, does your heart long for the same people that God longs for? You see, God wants you to have a heart for the people around you and a desire for them to have a relationship with him. And you don't have to look very hard to find people around you to care about, right? Like, they're everywhere. They're on your street. They're at work. They're at your gym. The people you interact with on social media. How about your own family members? Jesus said that one of the greatest commandments, one of the most important things that you can do is love your neighbor. Love your neighbor is something that we can get behind. It's an idea that we like, but it can actually be difficult to do sometimes. Well, why is that? Why does it sound good, but we have a hard time carrying it out? One roadblock is this us versus them mindset that's just so rampant in our culture today. We are polarized, we're divided. The labels that we give people, the wedges that we put between us, that creates a gap so big that it really becomes difficult to actually connect with someone in a meaningful way. But Christians should choose, make a choice, reject the negativity, look past the labels, knock down the dividing walls, and love people the way God loves people. Love your neighbor means even loving the people that are difficult, loving relentlessly, loving unconditionally. Another culprit that gets in the way of having a heart for people is chronic busyness. Now, I know you're busy, I'm busy, that's normal, but you're at an unhealthy level of busyness when you've got no time to focus on people. In our hectic world, you've got to slow down. You have to prioritize time and put people above your own tasks and responsibilities. People come first. It's also hard to love people when we think we're above them. If you're looking down on somebody, then that makes it challenging. So do you know what prompted Jesus to tell the story of the lost coin? You can read about it in Luke chapter 14. It comes before he tells these three parables in chapter 15. And it's good to look at the chapters before and after a text that you're reading just to see how does this fit into a larger story. So in Luke chapter 14, Jesus is invited to a banquet, and he gets to the banquet, and he sees that people are posturing. They're trying to sit at the most important and honorable seat. They're trying to look like they're important and special. And so I love this. Jesus just starts talking and kind of teaching, and he talks about being humble, about taking the least important place at the party. And then he goes on to tell this story about a guy that throws a big banquet. And the twist in his story is that the host of the party actually invites all the riffraff from the outskirts of the city to come in and fill up his party. And as Jesus is talking, there's people nearby that they're rough around the edges and they're kind of looked down on by society. And so, you know, they like the sound of this teaching. They start gathering around him. They want to hear more. Well, the self-righteous religious leaders see this happening. This is always like the uh-oh moment in a story with Jesus. Like, what are the Pharisees going to do this time? So these religious leaders see this, and they start muttering to each other and talking and saying, like, look at this guy Jesus. What does he think he's doing? The text says they they said, he welcomes sinners. He eats with them. How did Jesus respond to the elites? Well, he says, hey, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you about a shepherd that left 99 of his sheep because one of them had wandered off. Have you heard about the lady that cleaned all day in search for her lost coin, and then she threw a party when she found it? How about the dad that sprints his heart out to get to his reckless son that has finally returned home? You see, Jesus' view of community is including everyone. The people that you least expect to be at the party actually have the seat of honor at the party. So not only does Jesus' story illustrate God's tremendous love for you, his tremendous love for all people, but he actually uses these stories as a cautionary tale for arrogant religious people that think they're better than everyone. And we need to be careful, because if you find yourself muttering about those people that don't belong, then you're on the wrong side of the story. You're in Pharisee territory, because God has a big heart for people on the fringes. And he wants you to have a soft spot for them too. Here's question 3. What if we all searched for God's treasures? What if all of us actively searched for God's treasures? This is the action item from question 2. When you have a heart for people, you want to be a part of the search party. And God's strategy for finding the people that he treasures, it's carried out by his church. It's carried out by us. Jesus empowers you to be a player in the search for lost treasures. And just don't be like this guy. So he put up his lost and found sheet. It says, it's kind of blurry. Whoever lost a bundle of $20 bills tied up in a rubber band, I found the rubber band. Not a good approach. Not helpful. Not the right attitude. When Jesus sent his followers in Matthew 28 to go and make disciples, he's saying, I'm entrusting you with reaching my people. I'm sending you out to grow my kingdom and to share my message of hope. So the first Christians, they could have been satisfied with everyone in their little community and just had a pleasant time. But Jesus imagined something greater. Jesus imagined a church that's compelled by the same longing that God has for humanity. And he gave the early Christians this vision to go. Go after people. Be on the lookout for missing treasures. And if you feel like you need tips or just ways to be better at having natural conversations about faith, we've got a gospel conversation training coming up next Sunday afternoon. You can participate in that. It's going to just give you tools that you can use. It'll help be a confidence booster for you. This calling to go is also why First Colony's vision is that we're all in connection groups. Because groups provide you a way to have community and to be in relationship with people, but it also gives you this easy next step for you to invite and include new people to join you. So here's the takeaways for today. 1, your value is not defined by your circumstances, and your value is not defined by how you even feel about yourself. Your value is seen through the eyes of your Creator, and he says and sees you as a treasure that is worth looking for. The second takeaway is, in Jesus' vision for community, everyone is invited to have a seat at the table. And the third takeaway is, you are a key player in Jesus' plan to grow his community. He's asking you, be on mission and go. Go make a bold difference at your home, in church, in the community, and beyond. What if we all searched carefully for God's treasures? What if we all had the guts to start a friendship with somebody that puts us out of our comfort zone? What if we loved more recklessly and loved all the people around us? The church would change the world. I hope you don't have to lose your snowboard and make a fool out of yourself like I did. I also hope that you can draw close to God and say, I am loved by my Father, I'm forever yours, because that has the power to give you the ability to see God's treasures in a new light. They are all around you, and everyone is included to have a seat at the table.